Hello, good morning. Welcome to the briefing for today, Friday the 14th of March. I was going to say happy Friday, but it is not a particularly happy Friday for children and many others in Sudan. We've issued a number of things on the situation in Sudan, but we're pleased today to have with us from New York. She's obviously up bright and early, and so we thank her for that. We have Lucia Elmi, the UNICEF Director of Emergency Operations, who's going to tell us more about the humanitarian situation for children in Sudan, which was taken up in the Security Council. The floor is yours. Welcome.
Thank you, and good morning, good afternoon. I would like to bring to your attention today the situation of children of Sudan. They're trapped in one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. I just returned from a week mission in Sudan, and I could witness firsthand the conflict, the displacement, and the hunger that have been destroying the life of so many children, millions of children. More than 16 million children in Sudan are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. Nearly 17 million children have been out of schools for 2 years. Girls face grave risk, including sexual violence, trafficking, and forced marriage. Over 12 million people are at risk of gender-based violence. Children are being killed, maimed, displaced, with grave violation reports on a daily basis. Many face recruitment and used by armed groups, child labor, early marriage. The psychological toll is devastating. Conflict, loss, and displacement have left children struggling with anxiety, depression, trauma. Urgent action is needed to protect Sudan's children. Reaching those children is becoming increasingly difficult. During my recent visit, we traveled to Kassala, to Gedaref, to Wad Madani. We were actually the first humanitarian mission since December 2023. Where I witnessed girls and boys being screened for malnutrition, mothers seeking urgent treatment for their children, and families desperate for clean water and sanitation. The needs are staggering, yet aid is not available at the scale and the speed required. At the same time, I saw something remarkable. I saw displaced and host community coming together to contribute to the delivery of humanitarian services. Children eager to learn, both from the host community and the displaced community, and for some eager to learn in a learning center, temporary learning centers. And for some of them, it was the first time in their life, their opportunity to be in a school environment. School is not only about learning, it also offers a sense of normalcy, hope, and protection. I also saw buses packed with a few possessions for families, the families could carry, heading back to areas where fighting has subsided. Sinjar, Sinnar, Wad Madani, parents are cautiously starting their journey back home, hoping that the condition will remain stable and they can start rebuilding their life. But I also met with families who are not able to return home. Their villages have gone, the community have been shattered. They remain stuck in a limbo with little hope for the future. Delivery on humanitarian aid continue to be inhibited by bureaucratic administrative impediments in obtaining the necessary permits for delivery of supply in areas affected by armed conflict. Ongoing conflict, ethnic-driven violence, and direct attacks on humanitarian workers and mutual aid groups are worsening an already in dire situation. Looting and violence have forced operational suspension in multiple areas. Last year, Sudan food crisis spiraled into famine, something we long have been warning about. And now we warn the situation is even worsening. Since April 2023, the number of people facing acute food insecurity has tripled. Famine conditions are occurring in at least 5 locations, including displacement camps in North Darfur and in the Western Nuba Mountains. Nationally, 3.2 million children under 5 years of age are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition this year, including 770,000 facing severe acute malnutrition, that is the deadliest form of hunger, nearly making children 11 times more likely to die from the disease. But this crisis is not only about food, it's about safe water, sanitation, healthcare, protection. In famine-affected areas, basic services are almost collapsed. Despite immense challenges, UNICEF remains on the ground, committed to stay and deliver. In 2024, we were able to provide psychosocial support, education, and protection services to 2.7 million children and caregivers, deliver safe drinking water to 9.8 million people, and screen 6.7 million children for malnutrition and provide life-saving treatment with partner to over 400,000 children. In 2025, we continue delivering urgent assistance while also working to restore essential services and build resilience in the hardest area. Sudan risks losing an entire generation. We call on all actors to act now, guarantee humanitarian access across conflict lines and borders, protect humanitarian workers and supplies, increase funding to match the escalating needs, and end violence. The children of Sudan cannot wait. The world must act now. I thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Elmi, for this briefing and for taking the time to speak to the Geneva Press Corps. Just as a reminder, you all know that the executive director of UNICEF, Catherine Russell, briefed the Security Council yesterday on this issue, and you know that the more than 30 million people, two-thirds of Sudan's total population, they require a humanitarian assistance this year. Out of those, 16 million are children. That's an enormous figure. So I'm going to, give the floor to anybody who may have a question on this issue. I do not see any online. I do not see any in the room. But thank you very much again, and good luck. As you know, UNICEF is appealing for the figure of $1 billion to deliver support to 8.7 million of the most vulnerable children this year. So thank you very much again, and we hope to see you again at this briefing, Lucia Elmi. I'm speaking of UNICEF and WHO. They both issued a joint press release yesterday on the situation of measles in the European region. And I'm happy today to have with us Christian Lindmeier from WHO, and I believe he's going to introduce Dr. Dragan Jankovic, who is the technical lead for measles from WHO Europe, who will be speaking to us from Copenhagen. Christian, take it away.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much, Michele. And actually, you did the invitation or the introduction already. Very glad to have with us Dr. Dragan Jankovic. He's the technical lead for measles at the WHO regional office in Copenhagen. And as you said, there's a joint communique together with UNICEF. There's also a joint statement. We'll send it out in a moment, or it's already on the way. And then I think it has already been shared last night. But in any case, Dragan, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. In our statement, both agencies and their directors, regional director for WHO Europe, Dr. Hans Kluge, and regional director for UNICEF Europe and Central Asia, Regina De Dominicis, stated that this situation, where we have almost 130,000 cases of measles reported in 2024, is unacceptable and call for immediate action. Our region was facing outbreaks in 2023 and 24, and during the 2024, besides this number of mentioned cases, we also have a situation that we have 38 deaths reported due to measles. We have a situation that almost 50% of cases are among children younger than 5. Both directors are stating this as a call for action on the level of population, on the level of countries. We need immediate action to increase immunization coverage, which was affected during the COVID pandemic and response to pandemic. But we also have to find a local situations which are building to this situation and which are not helping countries to early detect cases, early detect outbreaks, and initiate timely and adequate response. Even in this year, for the January 2025, we already have 3,000 cases reported. We saw that number of cases is going down by the end of 2024. However, traditionally, or by data epidemiology that we are receiving from the countries, usually number of cases is increasing at the beginning of the year. And in European region, majority of cases are happening in the period February to May. This is timely call for action because, again, huge catch-up activities have to be done first for measles, but also for all other diseases for which children were not immunized due to pandemic, first of all. But we are also asking countries to define and map reasons in health system, in acceptance of vaccine, in cooperation with different structures inside the country, not only health system, but also educational and social care, and to deal with these gaps. The region have a target of measles and rubella elimination. We have only three countries which are missing status of rubella elimination to be verified, but we have something like 10, 15 countries which are still endemic for measles or which achieve interruption or elimination of measles, but losing that status usually because importation of virus and inadequate outbreak response.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jankovic. I have a question from Antonio Broto from EFE. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So I read the press release yesterday, and I saw that the countries with more cases in Europe are all in Eastern Europe, also some of them in Central Asia. Do you know what's the reason? And is WHO concerned about the situation in some countries in Western Europe as well?
Thank you for the question. Yes, if you look for the most recent data, the biggest burden of disease was happening in the countries of Central Asia and in South Europe, as you mentioned. If you look, it's Kyrgyzstan, it's Romania, Kazakhstan, the Russian Federation, Turkey, Bosnia and Herzegovina. But we also have cases and outbreaks reported in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, and the other countries. The point is that there is a susceptible population in every single of our countries. The reasons, background, and activities to be taken are different. Some are similar, some are not. So there is a need for better understanding of situation in each of the countries and in each of affected population that needs further investigation. The second issue is impossibility to control importation. Right now, I think we have few countries in the south and the west of Europe, Spain and France, reporting importations and cases related to importations to this country. So the situation in this moment looks like you said, it is to be followed and to be addressed with immediate intervention. Reasons, again, first of all, is breaking of the routine services during pandemic years, but also it can be related with inadequate population data, movement of population, refusal of vaccination, but segments of population, insecure position of the healthcare workers, dealing with immunization and the patients. Very, very different variety of reasons are reported by countries.
Thank you very much. I'm looking to see whether there are other questions online or in the room. I'm going to take a moment to see. If not, perhaps, I'll thank you, Dr. Jankovic, for your participation. Perhaps you, if you don't mind just staying on a little longer in case there are further questions, we'll stay with WHO, as I believe Christian has an announcement for us. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much again, Michele, and thanks, Dr. Jankovic. You've also seen this announcement from last night, but I thought it's absolutely worth to repeating. On 13 March, yesterday, the Ministry of Health of the United Republic of Tanzania declared the end of the Marburg virus disease outbreak. This declaration came after two consecutive incubation periods, a total of 42 days, since the last person confirmed with MVD died on 28 January 2025 and was given a safe and dignified burial in accordance with WHO recommendations. No new confirmed cases were reported since then. The outbreak was declared on 20 January 2025. As of 12 March, and apologies for the many dates in here, but as of 12 March, 2 confirmed and 8 probable cases were reported by the Ministry of Health from Biharamulo district in the Kagera region. All 10 cases died, which makes it a case fatality ratio of 100%, including 8 who died before the confirmation of the outbreak. A total of 272 contracts that were listed for monitoring completed that 21-day follow-up as of 10 February 2025. WHO, through its country office and partners, provided technical, operational, and financial support to the government to contain this outbreak. The risk of reemergence of MVD, Marburg virus disease, remains after the official declaration of the end of the outbreak linked to the animal reservoirs presence in the country. That's important. WHO encourages maintaining early case detection and care capacities in addition to sustaining the ability to quickly respond and continued risk communication and community engagement. To note at the same time that the Director General, Dr. Tedros, also directly reached out to Secretary of State Rubio on the importance of international cooperation on X last night, and he said, does it make America safer? One of these three questions that Secretary of State Rubio once answered for each policy and investment question. WHO is helping make Americans and everyone safer by working with all countries to stop infectious and deadly outbreaks like Marburg and Ebola at their source. Cutting ties would make Americans unsafe. Let's tighten global health security together. Thank you.
Thank you, Christian. I think something you said may have sparked the interest of Stéphane Boussard from Le Temps. Stéphane, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Michele. Yes, since Christian is talking about this conversation with the U.S. Secretary of State, I have a question about a question that has already been asked. But since the UN agencies have received a questionnaire from the Trump administration that tackle those issues, what will the UN do with this questionnaire? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Stéphane. Let me just start on that, and then. I speaking on behalf of the United Nations in Geneva, I don't believe that, to the best of my knowledge, we've not received this questionnaire, so it's a bit difficult to talk about it, from our perspective. And, the Secretary General has no comment as of yet. I don't know that it's been received at that level. So we're trying to understand at what level and, who's exactly receiving it. We know that a number of our UN agencies and entities have received it, and I believe that here in Geneva, at least one UNAIDS has acknowledged receiving it. So I'm going to leave it at that. I don't know whether there's a whether Christian, whether you have anything since you mentioned the questions, whether you have anything to add from the WHO perspective, or whether anybody else online has. Anything to add to that?
Michele, yeah, thank you. Just in the same context, we have received multiple communications from the United States agencies and department relating to various projects, and which we will, of course, carefully consider. That's it, what it has.
Thank you. I don't see anybody else, volunteering on this, but Stéphane, you have a follow-up, I'm sure. Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much indeed. So you basically confirm that UNAIDS received and other agencies received this questionnaire. So you don't have any kind of plan to respond to it, or
I think that that there is a. It's not clear to me that it's the same questionnaire going out to everybody and at the same level. So that's one thing. I know that I cannot speak for UNAIDS, but I know that they have confirmed receiving it, and I do believe that just in as a question of general principle, a lot of the, several of the UN agencies and entities have different statutes, and so maybe it may not be a one size fit all type of response. So that's more or less what I can say about that at this stage, I think. I think that each entity that receives this will deal with it in its in its own way, and that the general principle is that we welcome engagement and interest of member states in the work that we do, and that we often we often receive requests from member states for information about the work that we do. So we take this in the same spirit. It's not related to this, but of course, in the spirit of encouraging member states to participate in the assessment of the fitness for purpose of the United Nations system, that of course the Secretary General has launched the UN-AT initiative recently, and that he's written to member states proposing a comprehensive assessment of a dedicated all of United Nations system task force that is appointed by Secretary General Antonio Guterres, and where there will be a number of proposals to member states about in three different areas. So efficiencies and improvements with current arrangements, the implementation of all the mandates that are given to the UN system from member states themselves, and the need for structural changes and program realignment within the United Nations system. So this was launched this week. I see a question from Catherine Fiancant. Catherine, the floor is yours.
Yes, good morning, Michele. Do you hear me?
We do, but a bit faintly.
Okay. So I will speak a little bit louder. Good morning to all. Thank you for giving me the floor. I'd like to know if when the SG will be in Geneva next week, if a meeting is scheduled with the UN agencies that received that questionnaire from the US authorities. Are there meetings planned in with the SG in order to discuss the consequences of the US decisions? Thank you, Michele.
Yes, Catherine. So the answer is no. As you know, the Secretary General will be here next week, but he will be here in the context of the meeting on Cyprus, and there's nothing envisaged along the lines of what you asked. Antonio, Efe. Go ahead.
Now that you mentioned the meeting on Cyprus, can you give us details on what's going to be? Will there be press conferences?
So to the last, to your last point, the answer is at this point no. But I can tell you the note will probably go out very soon if you haven't received it already. So we can confirm that the Secretary General will convene the two Cypriot leaders and the guarantor powers of Greece, Turkey, and the United Kingdom for an informal in-person meeting, on Cyprus in Geneva next week. This informal meeting, which is being held in the context of the Secretary General's good offices efforts on the Cyprus issue, and is in line with his commitment from the 15th of October 2024, will provide an opportunity for a meaningful discussion on the way forward on the Cyprus issue. to get to media arrangements. Visual media will be able to cover the arrival of delegations here at the Palais des Nations at door A11 on Tuesday, the 18th of March, around 11 a.m. So this is where delegations are arriving. Following that, a pool of visual media that is, it's a pool, so you'll need to organize amongst yourselves, will have access to the family photo, which is being taken in front of room 3, and to the photo spray at the beginning of the plenary meeting, which is also envisaged to take place in room 3. Our UNTV colleague Gilles Serigny will organize this pool. If you want to contact him directly, I think you know how. But at this point, there is no press conference or press stakeout foreseen or in the program at the conclusion of the meeting. But should this change, as it sometimes does, you will be informed as soon as possible. I hope that answers your questions, but I see there's another question from Laurent Sierro. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for that. Could you repeat the scheduled arrival at door 11? Because I thought that there were two sets of meetings on Tuesday. The first one, bilateral meetings between the SG and each of the delegation, which would take place earlier in the morning, and then a plenary at the end of the morning. So you seem to have a different schedule. So could you repeat that? Thank you.
Yeah, so the arrivals at the Palais des Nations are around 11 a.m. on Tuesday, the 18th of March. And, you know, that's the schedule at present. If there's anything else, I'll let you know. Emma.
Yeah, just to clarify, can you repeat the duration? I know from Monday, but when does it end? And what level government representatives do you expect from Greece, Turkey, the United Kingdom, please? And if you have any names, that would be great. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. So what was your first question? I'm sorry.
Duration.
It's expected to last until the... you know, the evening of Tuesday. So, you know, not far past that. You know, there's not, you know, an exact end time to these things as there often is, but I would say, you know, currently we're looking at, you know, close of the business day on Tuesday. I hope that answers the question. In terms of list, I don't have a list for you at present. I will see whether there's anything that we can share with you or publish. Some delegations are represented at ministerial level. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so for the information. Probably Mr. Guterres will have dinner on Monday with the leaders and guarantor powers as well. It will be probably in Intercontinental Hotel. Is there an opportunity for journalists to go there and take photo or video or as for some statement?
Thank you. Look, I mean, as you know, there are no photo ops during dinners, you know, normally. So no is one answer, but we expect that, of course, there are official media traveling with the delegations, and that they will probably have an opportunity to take a photo of the, you know, welcome handshake, you know, at the hotel. So it's not a, you know, it's not an open photo op. It's sort of individual greetings by the Secretary General, and, you know, it'll be official media at that point. But there's no, you know, there's no photography or videography during the dinner, of course. Okay, thanks for the question, though. Catherine, and then hopefully we'll give Jennifer a chance to talk to us about Syria.
Yes, Michele, could you please share with us all the details of the people that are the media contacts from the delegations? That would be very useful. Thank you.
Sure. Yes, I'll ask the office to share that around. Thanks very much. Good point. Jennifer.
Good morning. I have a statement from Mr. Pedersen, the UN Special Envoy for Syria. It is 14 years since Syrians took to the streets in peaceful protest, demanding dignity, freedom, and a better future. Their calls resonated across the country, sparking a movement that would shape Syria's history. What began as a plea for reform was met with staggering brutality, leading to one of the most harrowing conflicts of our time. The conflict exposed the darkest depths of human cruelty. Families continue to mourn the loss of loved ones. Communities remain fractured. Millions remain uprooted from their homes. And far too many persist in their search for the missing. The pain and sacrifices of the Syrian people must never be forgotten. Yet the resilience of Syrians and their pursuit of justice, dignity, and peace endure. And they now deserve a transition that is worthy of this. More than 3 months since the fall of the Assad regime, Syria now stands at a pivotal moment. Syrians have experienced emotions of great hope in these times, but also of deep fears. Renewed fighting following attacks against the caretaker authorities and appalling violence perpetrated against civilians have given rise to grave concerns about the future. The Special Envoy calls for an immediate end to all violence and the protection of civilians in accordance with international law. He calls for a credible, independent investigation into the recent killings and violence, and for the cooperation of the caretaker authorities with the United Nations in this regard. A climate of distrust and fear could endanger the entire transition. Building on and beyond the recent national dialogue, it is vital that there are concrete actions of genuine inclusion. The recent agreements reached between the caretaker authorities and the SDF are a positive reminder of how important it is that Syria comes together in a manner that truly restores its sovereignty, unity, independence, and territorial integrity, and also the need for genuine inclusion and compromise in the transition. And Syrian civil society continues to play a crucial role in local dialogues and vital peace-building efforts. The Special Envoy notes that the caretaker authorities have issued a constitutional declaration. He hopes this will move Syria toward restoring the rule of law and promoting an orderly, inclusive transition. Now is the time for bold moves to create a genuine, credible, and inclusive transitional government and legislative body, a constitutional framework and process to draft a new constitution for the long term that is credible and inclusive too, and genuine transitional justice. The United Nations stands ready to work on these and all other aspects of a political transition in cooperation with the caretaker authorities and all Syrians and in line with key principles of Security Council Resolution 2254. We will continue to stress the importance of Syrian women's full political inclusion in the institutions of the transition. The United Nations will also continue to appeal for the international community to support Syria too. All states should respect the sovereignty, unity, independence, and territorial integrity of Syria and not take steps to interfere or make the transition more difficult. And sanctioning and donor states should make the necessary moves to ensure an environment in which the transition can succeed. After 5 decades of one-man rule, and 14 years of conflict, we need to ensure a stable and prosperous Syria in which Syrians can realize their legitimate aspirations. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Just to call your attention to the fact that the Secretary General also issued a statement on Syria yesterday. I'm sure you've all seen it, but just to call your attention to it again, he concluded the statement that he issued by reiterating that we, the United Nations, stand ready to work alongside the Syrians and support an inclusive political transition, and we stand with the Syrian people towards the promise of a better Syria for all Syrians. Jamie, you have a question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Michele. Hi, Jennifer. Just wanted to clarify that I didn't miss an email. This is your comment about how the special envoy is calling for a credible, independent investigation of the recent killings and violence and the cooperation of the caretaker authorities. Is that the first time he has made that call, or has he said that previously? I just wanted to make sure, because it's been a few days since this violence has happened. Thank you.
I cannot remember the wording of all the phrases that he have used in his delivery to the Security Council briefing, but of course those are online. I mean, you know, Mr. Pedersen has since December 8th and before has urged accountability for all crimes, and he has welcomed the announcement, and I believe that the UN Human Rights Office has also discussed this, you know, calls to ensure that investigations are undertaken in prompt, thorough, independent, and impartial manner.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'm going to just wait a second and see whether there are any questions on this. If not,
and just a note on his forward plans, he will be at Brussels for the Brussels conference, along with another number of UN principals, and scheduled to brief the Security Council, I believe, on the 25th of March at the end of the month.
Yes, thank you very much. Important to point that out. We're joined now by our friends from IFRC. Tommaso Della Longa is here. Let him introduce his guest.
Thank you very much, Michele. Good morning, all. So today we will going to brief you on the Red Cross response to the Ebola outbreak in Uganda. And to do so, we have our IFRC Public Health in Emergencies Coordinator, Henry Mbata Muzembi, who is currently in Kampala, and he will brief us on our work. And just to add that if you are interested in any audiovisual material, please be in touch with us, because we have plenty to share. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tommaso, and hello, colleagues. I'm joining you this morning from Kampala to talk about the outbreak of Sudan Ebola virus disease in Uganda that was declared by the Minister of Health at the end of January this year. This is the country's eighth Ebola outbreak since the year 2000. And six of these outbreaks have been caused by the Sudan virus strain, which belongs to the family of Ebola viruses, causing pyrohemorrhagic fevers, among other distressing side effects. Within epidemic response, but particularly with such a severe and often fatal disease like this, which has the potential to strike such fear in the population and to quickly spread, community diplomacy is essential for the Red Cross and other humanitarian actors to help contain it. So building trust and knowledge amongst communities in order to balance ensuring people are rightly cautious and on guard, letting them know it's a virus which should be taken very seriously, while also trying to reduce the stigma which could affect reporting levels, is key. Central to this community-based work is the role of volunteers, who are always the backbone of the Red Cross, Red Crescent response. And in this instance, the Uganda Red Cross has trained and deployed 320 volunteers from affected areas. And these are people who are already trusted members of their communities, selected in close collaboration with those communities and their leadership. The Uganda Red Cross volunteer health outreach is part of village task forces throughout the country, which have been activated and coordinated by Uganda Red Cross Society. They support awareness creation on how Sudan virus disease presents, the actions to take if you suspect you are sick or a family member is affected, how and where to get prompt medical care, preventive and control measures against the disease, and also offering psychosocial first aid. This mental health support is important to bolstering the resilience of the population who experienced a similar devastating outbreak only 3 years ago. Uganda Red Cross Society ambulances are also on standby to transport people showing symptoms of the disease to quarantine and Ebola treatment centers. Misconceptions about the disease and these centers often abound. At the start of the outbreak, for example, communities had fears that reporting suspected Ebola cases may lead to forced quarantine by the government, and that once people would be taken to the quarantine centers, they would die. However, I have seen Uganda Red Cross volunteers engage communities in high-risk districts by listening to their concerns and sharing this feedback with us for analysis. And in return, we develop timely targeted messages to address rumors and allay fears. This has led to building community trust and improved community reception to Sudan virus disease preventive and control measures, including quarantine and to community members voluntarily reporting if they or their family develop symptoms of the disease. Over the years, Uganda Red Cross Society has also supported the Ugandan government to conduct safe and dignified burials during Ebola outbreaks. And in this epidemic, they have deployed 6 teams to support this vital work. Uganda Red Cross has adopted lessons learned from previous outbreaks into this current response. For instance, in 2022 Ebola outbreak, Uganda Red Cross Society successfully managed to balance safe burial needs alongside cultural practices and beliefs linked to the burials. They have done this by engaging families and community leaders to find acceptable promises, compromises that respect tradition while keeping the living safe. The IFRC is appealing for 6 million Swiss francs to support the Uganda Red Cross in strengthening its response in the districts that have confirmed positive cases, while scaling up readiness in the most at-risk districts. Donations received will be used to support over 500,000 across the country with a range of services, many of which I've already mentioned, such as risk communication and community engagement, community-based surveillance and contact tracing, safe and dignified burials, transportation of suspected cases, community hygiene and sanitation support, and also the provision of adequate personal protective equipment. But so far, the appeal is only 5% funded. Swift and coordinated action in response to this deadly virus is paramount to containing it, and that can only be achieved with more awareness and funding. Thank you, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Musembi, for connecting with us from Kampala, and for briefing us on this important aspect of the Ebola response in Uganda. I'm going to wait a minute here to see whether there are any questions either online or in the room. I see Emma Farge from Reuters. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the briefing. I'm just wondering how concerned you are about U.S. budget cuts to the response. Are you managing to fill the gaps, or are the gaps quite big and dangerous for the spread? Thank you.
Thanks, Emma, for the question. I'm happy to take this one. Of course, there is a global concern in terms of budget cuts to the humanitarian sector. Now, in particular, on the Ebola response, the good news is that the U.S. authorities on the 4th and 5th of March 2025 reconfirmed the support to some of our activities, which includes also our epidemic and pandemic program, and in particular, the Ebola response. But then what we are doing currently in Uganda, of course, is not only an effort of one donor. I mean, we have several different donors who are approaching us or already working with us. I'm thinking about ECHO and a couple of partner national societies who are supporting the Uganda Red Cross response. So, of course, we will welcome any other support for our emergency appeal. And, of course, we're looking also in different funding, including in private sector. Thank you.
Thank you, Tommaso. Jamie Keaton, AP.
Hi, thanks, Tommaso, for that. Could you be specific about exactly which programs at the U.S., a little bit more specific, if you could, about which funding programs that the U.S. had has confirmed on March 4th and 5th, as you mentioned? And if I might also add, while I've got you, have you noticed any other, you mentioned private sector donors, have you noticed private sector donors or other countries that have stepped up in wake of these U.S. cuts to possibly help fill the gaps that you have in funding? Thanks.
Thank you, Jimmy, for the question. Well, I will start from the last one. As you know, the situation is pretty volatile and changing pretty quickly. So I think that it's too early to speak about a trend or a number of countries or private sector companies that are approaching us to fill any possible gap that, again, is not only related to one individual government, but it's a worrying trend that we've been seeing since a while. We are having different discussion with different donors, I mean, traditional donors and new donors. And of course, this is positive. But again, I think that it's too early to speak about a trend on that. Then on the other question, on 4 and 5 March 2025, the USAID reconfirmed their support to four IFRC grants. And one is this, multi-year grant for health preparedness and response, which is also covering the Ebola response in Uganda, emergency response in Ukraine, Zimbabwe operation regarding water sanitation, and then our operation to respond to the needs of people arrived in Armenia. So these are the four grants that were reconfirmed. And in addition to these four grants, we have other four who are still there, open. One on food security in DRC, response to Hurricane Beryl in Jamaica, life-saving activities in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, and immunization in several fragile contexts through US CDC. Of course, this doesn't mean that other programs were not terminated, which is exactly the case. Thank you.
Thank you for that detail, Tommaso. I think Jamie may have a follow-up.
Yes, I do. Thank you. I'm sorry about that. Thank you, Tommaso. Really great. Thank you for the details. Could you just, if I could take it a quick step further, do you have numbers on the amount of money for each of those programs, or at least the cumulative amount? And in terms of the programs, is there any way to say how many those programs represent in the overall total of programs that you mentioned some had been terminated? So just could you give us some perspective as to like what percentage of the overall total of American funded projects and programs at IFRC or within the Red Cross, Red Crescent Movement are being maintained? Yeah. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Jimmy. First, I want to make clear that I'm talking about grants that are directly financing programs of the IFRC. So then it's a different story for programs who are that are supporting national society activities or other movement components. Then, I mean, the short answer is actually no, and I explain. I mean, on the percentage. I mean, as we all know, we had different communication arriving from U.S. authorities since the end of January. So then also in the understanding of life-saving activities, termination letter, then letters that were rescinding, if I may call it in this way, the termination letter. So it's something that we are still assessing and discussing. It's important to say that we have open dialogue with the U.S. Authorities about that. Then in terms of every single program that I mentioned before, I'm happy to take it offline and give you more details further on.
Thank you, Tommaso. Very useful. I'm going to look and see if there are any more questions on this from anybody online in the room. Oh, go ahead, Agnes.
Yes, thank you. It's a follow-up on that. You say that the grant considering about the Ebola response in Uganda was validated or continued. But in general, is there any impact on the, your Ebola answer globally, not just in Uganda, but if you have other activities? And there's something I didn't understood. You say that four were still open, but that doesn't mean that others are not terminated. So could you clarify what do you mean? Do you mean that some activities has been shut down because of the lack of U.S. fund? Thank you.
Yeah. No, thank you for this follow-up. And sorry if I was not clear. So in terms of the Ebola response, I would say that this follows, in speaking only about the U.S. part, because as I was saying, we have different other donors who are supporting the Ebola response. When it's coming to U.S. funds, the entire program on epidemic and pandemic was confirmed. So the money and the support is still there. When I was talking about the other four grants open, it's just because there is, of course, we are in contact with different bodies of the U.S. government. So there are some funds that were coming from USAID and some other funds that were coming directly from the State Department and from USCDC. So this is where the four grants, some of those four grants that are still open were sitting. And then in terms of termination, we are still actually understanding the impact of it and also in how we can fill the gap if and where needed, and how we can rethink about our humanitarian approach in these different programs. So again, it's very difficult at the moment to comment in particular on these programs, because of course what we were doing was also in a team effort way. So it's not only one donor supporting one program, but then there are also several different ways to support those programs.
So does it mean that no program has been terminated? And if some have been terminated, could you say specifically which ones?
There is a risk that has been assessed internally. So at the moment, there is no real termination of programs. Of course, we have been reorienting some of our work on purely what is called life-saving activities. But then there is no termination per se at the moment. And then, of course, we will update I would say not only the media, but first and foremost the communities we serve when and if we'll have to terminate programs.
I think there are more questions online. Emma Farge, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Tommaso. Just seeking a little bit more clarification. So I thought the review process was over and the termination letters had been sent. So that means you haven't received any, but do you still think it's possible? Thank you.
No, to make it clear, we received termination letters, but then we also received in the four cases that I mentioned, including the Ebola response, another letter saying that the funds were reconfirmed. So we are looking into it and the exact meaning of it. And then when it's coming to programs that were terminated and then we didn't get any follow-up information, we are trying to understand how and if we will be able to continue these programs without U.S. funding.
Thank you. Laurent, you had a question, but perhaps not anymore. Perhaps not. Christiane, DPA, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Tommaso. I'm being confused now, too. If you say four grants are open, what exactly do you mean? Is it U.S. grants, or is it the total grant for a program where part of it is U.S. funding? Can you just clarify that? Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I'm not clear today. I have to admit that has been even complicating to assess everything for us in the last weeks and also to follow up all the news that were coming. So we got first the pause of funding at end of January. Then there were termination letters that didn't affect four grants that I mentioned, so food security in DRC, Hurricane Beryl in Jamaica, Cox Bazar, and immunization in several fragile contexts with USCDC. Then afterwards, we got four letters saying that the termination letter were not valid anymore, and they were still supporting other four grants, including the Ebola response. So in total, let's say there are eight that are still on, and others around, I don't want to give a an exact number because I may be wrong, but it should be around 20 that were terminated, and we are looking into what does it mean exactly for our operations.
Thank you. So I wasn't wrong. Laurent has a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Actually, I was about to ask about the impact on the workforce and also potential partners in terms of jobs that could have been cut. And then Tommaso said that no real termination of program has taken place yet. But still, since January the 1st or January the 20th, has IFRC taken any preventive measures in terms of either job force or internal procedures in order to anticipate potential future cuts, or not at all? Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. Well, I think that this is part of a broader discussion. If you remember here in this room when we were talking about the 3 years mark of Ukraine, there was a question about that, and we have been saying, you know, even between 2022 and 2023, we had a budget cut of millions coming from different other donors. So it was something about 70, we lost 70 millions in a year. So of course, we are looking into how to work in a more, if you want, sustainable, efficient, and direct with our partners, national societies. So, of course, this is something that we are looking into it, and our leadership is working on it. There is an ongoing discussion, so I cannot really enter in any specific details at the moment. And this is the second question. Now I'm missing the first one. Sorry, Laurent. You asked about? Which was the first one?
Laurent, I don't know if we can't hear you. There was a first question.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Neither of us can remember, actually.
No, sorry. It took time to unmute myself again. No, it was just no real impact in terms of workforce within IFRC for now.
It's too early to say that. Of course, there is an impact, and we don't want to underestimate it, but we are still assessing and discussing on how to move forward.
Thank you.
Of course.
Thank you all. I think that looks like it's it for the questions, Tommaso. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm going to call Catherine to the podium. Thank you. I'm speaking into the mic. I got it. Thanks.
Bonjour à tous. Deux annonces aujourd'hui. La semaine prochaine, la CNUSED organise dès lundi et pour 3 jours la conférence internationale sur la gestion de la dette qui s'inscrit dans le programme de travail sur le financement du développement qui va mener à la conférence internationale sur le financement du développement fin juin à Séville, donc en Espagne, le FFD4 en anglais. Bien sûr, la dette est un élément essentiel du financement du développement et de nombreux pays sombrent aujourd'hui dans une crise de développement liée à leur niveau d'endettement. Leur dette publique devrait atteindre le chiffre record de 5 300 milliards de dollars en 2024, soit 90% de leur PIB. La dette publique en elle-même n'est pas un problème, elle le devient lorsque les coûts du service de la dette augmentent plus que la capacité de paiement d'un pays donné. C'est désormais le cas pour plus des 2/3 des pays en développement, avec une énorme détérioration entre 2017 et 2023 suite aux crises que l'on connaît. De nombreux pays donc sont confrontés à des difficultés croissantes et doivent faire passer le remboursement de leur dette publique avant leurs objectifs de développement ou d'action climatique, et où. Bien sûr, les deux doivent être menés de front. Par conséquent, les pays ne sont peut-être pas en défaut de paiement de leurs dettes, mais ils sont en défaut de développement. Aujourd'hui, 3,3 milliards de personnes vivent dans un pays qui dépense plus pour rembourser sa dette que pour investir dans la santé ou l'éducation. et on compte 3 milliards de ces personnes dans des pays à revenus intermédiaires, donc pas forcément les plus pauvres de ces, des pays du monde. La conférence de lundi réunira nos partenaires habituels, dont les gestionnaires de la dette, soit auprès des gouvernements, soit dans des institutions financières, les responsables gouvernementaux, des universitaires, d'autres organisations internationales et la société civile au sens large. Et bien sûr, vous êtes les bienvenus. Ça se passera en salle 19 et la liste des intervenants est disponible sur notre site web. La réunion explorera les moteurs et les solutions possibles à la crise de la dette actuelle et à la crise du développement qu'elle induit, ainsi que des stratégies innovantes dans la manière de gérer la dette. Je vous rappelle que la CNUSED est pilote dans la mise à disposition des États de la gestion de leur dette par un outil qui s'appelle DEMFAS, dont vous trouverez également les détails sur le site de la conférence qui se tient lundi. Sur un autre front, nous allons publier aujourd'hui le Global Trade Update, donc pour mars 2025, et je peux vous annoncer qu'il va devenir une publication mensuelle. Jusqu'à aujourd'hui, c'était une publication trimestrielle. Dans ce rapport, dont les chiffres vont jusqu'à fin 2024, on note que la valeur des importations et des exportations mondiales a atteint un nouveau sommet l'année dernière, donc à 33 000 milliards de dollars, soit une croissance de 3,7%. Les incertitudes actuelles assombrissent les perspectives pour 2025, mais en restant sur 2024, il semble que il est montré par nos économistes que les services et les économies en développement sont les moteurs de la croissance que l'on relève. La plupart des régions donc sont en croissance, à l'exception de l'Europe et de l'Asie centrale. Les services ont été le moteur de 60% de cette croissance globale, avec un taux annuel de plus 9% et un montant global de 700 milliards de dollars. Le commerce des marchandises a lui aussi augmenté, mais plus faiblement, à 2% et un ajout de 500 milliards de dollars. La croissance du commerce a également varié selon les secteurs. L'agroalimentaire, les technologies de la communication et les transports sont en hausse, tandis que l'énergie, l'habillement et les industries extractives ont ralenti leur progression à cause d'une demande plus faible. En 2024, donc, les économies en développement ont dépassé les pays développés, avec des importations et des exportations en hausse de 4% pour l'année. Le commerce sud-sud, lui, a augmenté de 5% sur l'année et 4% au dernier trimestre. On note un ralentissement. Les déséquilibres commerciaux de marchandises s'accentuent. Vous avez dans le document que je vais vous envoyer des tableaux qui donnent les déséquilibres commerciaux entre les pays. Et on est en revenu en fait au niveau de 2022 dans le volume de ces déséquilibres. Voilà, le document est disponible dans quelques instants. Je vais vous l'envoyer également par email. C'est un document de 27 pages avec beaucoup d'infographies. Si vous avez besoin, bien sûr, des chiffres, on est prêt à vous les envoyer, à vous les donner et les experts à prendre vos questions. Je vous remercie. Bon week-end.
Merci, Catherine. Je vais attendre une petite minute pour voir s'il y a des questions là-dessus. Et pour l'instant, j'en vois pas. Par contre, je vois un message de la part de Antonio Brotto de EFE. Can we receive Office Special Envoy for Syria and UNICEF notes? I think there's a thumbs up there, so I'm just putting it out there for our colleagues. Please send your notes and we'll circulate them to the Geneva Press Corps. Merci, Catherine. Moving on, as you know, the Human Rights Council is continuing its 58th session today. There are also a number of treaty body meetings, including the Human Rights Committee, which is closing on Friday, the 28th of March. The concluding observations will be on the reports of the five countries review: Montenegro, Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mongolia, and Albania. The Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is concluding this. It's concluding this morning its review of the report on Palau, I believe. think there's a misspelling there. So Palau, but other countries who have been reviewed or are being reviewed are Tuvalu, Dominican Republic, Vietnam, Canada, European Union. Committee on Enforced Disappearances is opening next Monday at 10 a.m. That's the 17th of March, of course, and it will go until the 4th of April at Palais Wilson. And it's going to hold dialogues on Serbia, Gambia, Central African Republic, Peru, Belgium, and Malta. Thank you. I think that what's left for me now is to talk about some press conferences, but I see a hand up from Jamie, so let's take the question. Jamie.
Sorry, Michaela, maybe I'm preempting what you were about to say, but I'm trying to just get a little bit more visibility about the Cyprus informal next week and Guterres's movements, if there are any press avails planned. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Perhaps you didn't hear us earlier on. So I think there's a note that's gone out. The arrivals are on the Monday, but there are no, you know, open press opportunities at that point. It's just, there's a dinner. There will be arrivals at the Palais on Tuesday the 18th around 11, and that's at door A11, so 11 at 11. After that, there will be pool photo op at in front of room 3 for the group photo and for the photo spray at the top of the meeting in room 3. That's really what I've got for you now. There are no planned sort of media statements or press conferences or stakeouts at the moment, but we'll let you know if something happens at the end of that meeting. Okay, I hope that answers your question. That's what we've got for you now. As far as press conferences, just do remember that today, 14th of March, 2 p.m. today in this room, there's the launch of the Iran fact-finding mission's latest report. The speakers are Sara Hossein, the chair of the Iran fact-finding mission, Shaheen Sardar Ali, who's the expert member, and as is Viviana Kristovich. On Monday, 17th March, we have a press conference by the special rapporteur on the situation of rights in Myanmar, of human rights in Myanmar, Tom Andrews, you know him well. That's at 2:30 p.m. in this room. On Wednesday, the 19th of March at 1 p.m., also in this room, the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine will hold a press conference with Eric Moser, the chair of the commission, Pablo de Greff, and Vrinda Grover, both commissioners. I see a hand up from Emma Farage. Go ahead.
Well, hi. I had a question maybe for UNHCR, but if any other agency wants to react, that would also be most welcome. My colleagues at AP had quite an astonishing overnight scoop where it said that US and Israel have reached out to officials of 3 African governments as potential destinations for resettling Palestinians from Gaza. I'm just wondering if Olga might have a reaction to that, whether that's legal under international law, for example. Thank you.
So let me just first on this reiterate what has been said before by the spokesman for the Secretary General on this issue, not specifically on what you referred to, this particular plan, but any plan that could or would lead to the forced displacement of people or any type of ethnic cleansing is something that we would obviously be against, as it is against international law. I don't know whether Olga, who's online, wants to add anything from the UNHCR perspective. I see her there, and I'll give her the floor.
Hi, thank you, Michele. Elma, thanks for the question. Not much to add. We've seen the media reports, but we are not involved or any decision or aware of any decision on this matter. Thank you, Michele. Thank you.
Thank you, Olga. Good to see you. If there is nothing further, it's a busy day, so I'll let you get on with your business and I'll get on with mine. Thank you very much for joining us. And see you soon.